Welcome back to the Medical Freedom Show. This is your host, Heather Lynn Heath Martin. Same person, slightly different name. I am in the process of a name change right now. And so I'm going by Heather Lynn when I can, when it's not too official. So enough about me. Today I am joined by a very special guest. I want to welcome to the show a patient activist named Frank Aflito. He is originally from our listening area in the Berkshire Hills. He's currently living in Denver, Colorado. He's a patient activist. He sent me a little blurb about himself, which I will do my best to read right now on the air. Frank Aflito fights chronic pain outside the pharmaceutical industrial complex as much as he is able, an ability that through education and networking becomes stronger and more robust every day. He actively advocates for health and wellness controls over our own bodies and a healthcare environment which has its origin as a public responsibility and is not linked to policies of monetary gain. Well, Frank, your vision sounds right in line with our vision here at the Medical Freedom Show, because that's exactly what we're pushing for as well, to have the right of say over our own bodies, to control our own healthcare. So welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And I'd like to hear a bit about your background and how you came from being somebody in our local area, just like me and the rest of us for the most part, and how you came into this work.
Sure. Thank you so much. I grew up with my own issues of physical limitations, abuses which were physically painful, which left lasting physical and psychological damages. When I talk about chronic pain, I focus on sort of a holistic perspective for myself, which would be physical, emotional, psychological, spiritual. You know, pain for me can manifest itself in many areas. For instance, my joint pain heightens when I am super stressed out. And so I see how things are sort of interconnected and interwork. I moved to Boston in the early 80s, leaving Agawam, Massachusetts, my hometown, at the foot of the Berkshires, as you say. And there I was exposed to a world involving everyone. So I knew people living on the streets. I knew people in quote-unquote high places. I worked a lot in the medical field in countries which were at war from Boston. So there was a book, for instance, called Where There Is No Doctor. And so there were a lot of medical professionals who were trying to train the trainer to go back to war zones, for instance, in Central America, and provide medical care that was based upon the ingredients that would be no cost and would be available to poor rural people. So, you know, those were the people that had the scientific knowledge, not Harvard. They had the medicines. They knew which herbs were curative for which maladies, etc. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of my way of being exposed outside of the Berkshires to a broader world.
Okay. All right. So that was a lot of information. I'm just trying to process a bit of what you were saying. You mentioned coming from some kind of abuse. Are you talking about like being abused as a child or?
Yes, I'm a survivor of child sexual abuse as well as an adult rape. I've had though it's been nipped in the bud, thanks to some very good programming, which I was able to control and initiate. You know, I have had a number of significant re-traumatization episodes and periods in my life. I suffer from what would be called CPTSD, which is complex PTSD and generalized anxiety disorder.
Mm-hmm. My heart goes out to you for having to live through such a horrible experience. So from that experience, it sounds like you went into a study of medicine. Is that what your PhD is?
Let's see, a BA was in psychology, but I looked at emotional reactions to dangers. So to me, that's mental health focused. My master's at the University of California was in health psychology. Mm-hmm. I was particularly looking at stress and coping in sexual violence and in war survivors. And then I broadened that work into my PhD, where I realized that one thing that impacted people's health was something we call impunity, where, you know, dictatorial militaries, for instance, were committing these massive genocidal human rights crimes, and there was no legal consequence for the commission of those crimes. And so this impunity, I found out, was a significant negative health impact on the persons affected by that impunity. So it wasn't just the violence. There was something in the families of the disappeared I came to call chronic ambiguity. You know, 20 years later, you don't know if they're alive or dead. You don't know if they're eating or hungry, if they're hot or cold, if they're being mistreated, you know. And so PhD was in social ecology. I take a very ecological approach to viewing health and wellness.
Excellent. I think that's such an important approach to take to it, because the mind, the spirit, the body are so intertwined. Like, one of the things I've talked about on the show is that regardless of the scientific evidence that you can put down on paper about a given treatment or a process, on some level, it's got to resonate with the patient in order for it to work with them.
I agree. I'm sorry.
I didn't want to cut you off either.
No, I know.
But so many times we see where people are being forced into a treatment or denied a treatment that they know is going to work for them, is going to benefit them. The system is, I want to get to what you were talking about too, about a healthcare environment that has its origins as a public responsibility and not linked to policies of monetary gain. I think what you have there is very on point, because we have a system that is mainly motivated for monetary gain. And it's very destructive to human beings.
It's killing people.
It is. It is absolutely.
It's killing children. Mm-hmm. Urban Mississippi and rural Mississippi, to take as one example, has worse health indicators than like most any other country in the world. The only place less healthy than an American Indian reservation in the Western Hemisphere is Haiti.
Mm. Well, I unfortunately haven't been to Haiti to experience what the conditions are like there, but can you tell us a little more about the Native American reservations and the conditions? Because that's something I'm very interested in and very interested in covering on our show, especially as we talk about how healthcare is impacting Americans throughout the country. We don't hear too much about what's going on the Indian reservations. I heard something recently about of Navajo reservation, I believe it was, receiving body bags instead of medical supplies for dealing with COVID-19 pandemic.
That was President Trump's answer to the request for masks and health equipment. In fact, the Trump administration sent body bags. If you remember, I taught at University of Puerto Rico, If you remember, after Hurricane Maria, Trump went to the airport surrounded by Secret Service, and he, like a football, tossed paper towels at people. There were over 5,000 Puerto Ricans who died in the streets, 6 months with no electricity to pump water in the tropical heat, no food handouts because the money from what is our quote-unquote U.S. territory did not come in to provide those supplies. Yes, I've seen some very negative things. I consider Puerto Ricans an indigenous people as well. But in any event, I can refer you to some wonderful people if you'd love to have them on your show who can talk very specifically about health concerns in Native American reservations. Sure.
Yes, I would be interested in talking more about that. That's something I would like to uncover more deeply.
Wonderful, wonderful. I can get you connected with some wonderful people.
I like to share the different perspectives of many different people on the show. We've had shows about the sickle cell disease that affects many African Americans.
Sure.
And that's very interesting because, again, we're having this situation where there's people in chronic pain who need the effective medicine that's not going to damage their liver, which is opium derived from the poppy flower. They're going through a terrible time because they might need it when they're young and they're able to get the treatment then. But once they're a teenager, they're labeled a drug seeker and a potential criminal, and they're discriminated against. And the situation has gotten so bad now that everyone who needs this medicine, regardless of their race or even their socioeconomic background to an extent, is encountering the same thing, being labeled a drug seeker. And well, we know what that's about. It's because the war on drugs is shifting focus and they want to perpetuate themselves. They want to continue the militarization of police, the feeding the prison industry.
Yes. I bet when Donald Trump goes for a prescription of hydrocodones, no one accuses him of drug-seeking behavior. I find it a very classist thing. Mm-hmm. I find it a very racist thing. There was no opioid abuse problem when it was on the res and when it was in the urban ghetto. Oh, when it hit, let's see, Minneapolis, when it hit, Apple Valley and Minnetonka Beach, all of a sudden Minnesota says we've got an opioid crisis. It's this whole idea when white people are dying, all of a sudden it's a bad thing. But
it appeared so conveniently right after the national shift towards cannabis legalization. Remember, cannabis has been the big cash cow of law enforcement for decades now.
Yes,
because it's very popular, and that leads to property seizures, automotive seizures, RVs, boats, all kinds of big ticket, big money things. And that
I agree.
Feeds those agencies involved in this war on drugs.
I taught criminology and criminal justice off and on for 20 years, though my specialty was war crimes, looking at the militarized actions and the financial and other abuses of quote-unquote law enforcement and the quote-unquote criminal justice system. I have many, many stories to tell at some other point, and certainly I would concur with you on exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, it just happens way too conveniently. And what we're seeing right now with people, quote unquote, dying from the street drugs. Well, we saw a very similar thing happen in the cannabis prohibition. Do you remember the paraquat? They sprayed this herbicide paraquat on the cannabis that was then imported to the United States. And then people were actually smoking a joint and going to the hospital, having ill effects. This convinced a whole generation that cannabis was actually dangerous.
Yes.
So they learned from the past. So if we want to create a new scare, you want people to think any street opiate is just 100% chance of death, then get some toxic chemicals out into the street. Get a tainted supply out there. Shut down anybody who's doing legitimate operations and getting a more pure form to the people. And that's what we're dealing with right now. That's what I see very clearly and why we're pushing towards this. We're talking about defunding the police right now in many areas. There's a
push
to defund the police, but I've been saying for years, let's end the drug war and let the law enforcement scramble for how they're going to then fund themselves. Because that's really how they've become funded, is through the property seizures. Now they're going after hospitals and clinics and those doctors' homes, their vehicles, their everything that they have. Doctors are actually a lot of times a little more socioeconomically well off than the average drug dealer per se. So that's more revenue coming in for law enforcement.
I agree with you completely. It's like an Easter egg hunt. It's like a resource snatch. Mm-hmm. I have a million stories. I won't go into them here, but I agree with you completely. You know, the marijuana industry now, even though legal, has illegal parts in it itself. There are a number of issues that impact our ability to access the things in health that we want. Of course, when someone from the elite, from the 1%, wants to get some heroin, they can buy pharmaceutical and they'll be fine.
Right.
So it's got class implications, it's got gender implications, mm-hmm. It's got, you know, all kinds of implications. In Puerto Rico, for instance, because no one has veins who's been using heroin for a long time, they mix the heroin, I don't know how that's cut, they mix it with anesthesia and with Adolf's meat tenderizer. So when people inject into a large pus-filled abscess, the meat tenderizer continues to tenderize the flesh, goes into the anesthesia, lessening the pain, and the heroin goes into the body. So the types of things that are allowed to occur on the street for people who are street narcotics users, mm-hmm. is absolutely deplorable. And to me, it's nothing short of genocide. Hitler took people out to firing squads. We just have a slow genocide in this country, but it's no less a genocide.
Whenever we have a prohibition, it leads to death.
Yes, I agree.
We had alcohol prohibition, and that brought forth alcohol that could kill you or make you blind in one shot.
Yes. I do not like meth. I do not like what it does to people, but I'm all for legalizing and governmentally controlling crystal meth, or else trying Adderall on people, whatever. But if people need, for their own mental health, because it's been depleted through abuses, that dopamine rush as a curative way, then it should be pure meth that they're getting. It shouldn't be the stuff they're putting, mm-hmm. diesel in and battery acid in on the street.
Yeah, and same thing with the opium or the heroin.
I agree.
But where is the natural smokable opium? They've been so effective of eradicating that from the street, something that kind of has its own natural checks and balances. It's harder to overdose on something that's more natural and regulatable.
Yes, sure. You have self-control.
Yeah,
you take one hit, then you say, well, you know, do I want more or not?
Yeah, and the recovery industry has become a thing.
I don't know if you know Amy Winehouse's song Rehab. It's a fabulous song. The lyrics, anyway, listen to it sometime. Great video too. But yeah,
out.
I mean, I have struggled with homelessness. If I were to walk into somewhere and say, I'm a drug user, I need help, and I need a 28-day rehab, I'd have my own freaking one-bedroom apartment in 30 days after my 28-day rehab. But being a regular person with economic difficulties, if you have housing problems, there's no room for you. The rehab industry is connected to, the victim assistance industry is connected to law enforcement. The rehab industry is connected to law enforcement.
Yeah,
the mental health court industry is all connected to
law enforcement. There's all these very interesting money trails leading every which way to and from it. And one of the things that I always find kind of mind-boggling is how they switch people over from heroin to something that's actually
more addictive
and harder to kick. I can't think of the name of it right now.
Methadone.
Yeah, methadone.
Yes, ma'am.
Right. Yeah. So people who've gone off of just heroin have one experience. People who've done that and then done the methadone, say it's a whole different world.
It's a form of social control. You are controlled by the criminal justice system and the social service system for the rest of your life because you have to go every day for your dose.
Right.
And that dose keeps you zombified, and that is a form of social control.
Yeah.
Jail without walls.
Instead of trying to empower you to use the natural substance, maybe to grow your own, I'd like to see a rehab where people are planting the poppies and actually going out and harvesting the sap and getting a better understanding of what they're actually working with.
Yes.
I think that could create a more healthy relationship with such substances.
I believe very much in education.
I
have gone back because it's legal, and in order to deal with my chronic pain, I've gone back to smoking cannabis since May 1st of this year. And I was in Seattle and Colorado, both places where it's legal. I would be doing it if it wasn't legal, I decided, because it is helpful. But I have been on the journey to find the proper strain or to find the proper strain for the proper condition. So I have a certain strain that I will use for chronic knee pain and arthritis pain, and another strain that I will use for mental focus for my PTSD.
I want to remind our listeners that you are tuned in to the Medical Freedom Radio Show on 90.7 WGXC ACRA, 90.7 FM. You're listening to Heather Lynn Martin, the host of the show. Today, I am speaking with Frank Aflito, who is a patient activist, many years of experience, and who's been delving into the psychology of pain and trauma and trying to work towards helping us all to get more rights over our own bodies. So welcome again, Frank. I'm very glad to have you
show. It's an honor to be here.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about the kind of work you've been doing to help people to have more say over their own bodies. I know you're in Denver, Colorado right now. So what are your current projects? Like, what's on your plate?
One thing that's very important to me, both as a sexual violence survivor and activist, is trying to assist people of all ages, people of all genders, understand that the control over their own bodies starts with letting someone else touch or not that body. And so for me, this is really important. I work a lot in the street with homeless women who have been frequently sexually victimized, who are at risk for, if not involved in, being victimized by sex trafficking, and something really important to me, which impacts all other forms of health, never mind their often drug using of unpure chemicals, as we were just talking about, Something that's very important to me is trying to work with homeless populations to understand boundaries, to form committees that will ensure safety and health in certain areas for their members. And then from there, I'm fully advocating, and I work with a woman who works out of Rosebud Reservation, who I'd like to recommend to you. You know, I fully advocate growing herbal medicine wherever you can and researching and studying on it. You know, I think getting educated is exactly what the United States system doesn't want. And the more educated we are, the more we can fight for the rights. Just because some dude walks in a white lab coat doesn't mean you have to do what he or she says.
Exactly. Absolutely. We need to have the right of say over our own bodies, because ultimately we're the ones who have to deal with the consequences.
Yes. You know what else bothers me? Litter. I'm a zero litter person. Litter, cigarette butts. I smoke.
Yeah.
There are things that, you know, we can be doing. We can push city governments to put up more recycled bins as we walk down the street near bus stops, etc. You know, I think that recycling, I think that composting, I think that having more recycled bins, etc., and zero litter, that all leads to greater access to health for all of us, irregardless of class, of genders, of person of color, etc. You know, this is something that we can all benefit from.
I want to go back to something you were talking about a moment earlier about consent and touch, like how that applies to the medical establishment, because it seems oftentimes I've seen the show House about a doctor, you know,
it's a live TV show.
And whenever I've watched it, I've always been appalled, because it's always been about somebody being forced into some kind of treatment against their will, but then at the end the all-knowing doctor was right and it was all good and people should just submit to their doctors and let them.
And he could pop pills, but he was a nice guy.
Yeah, exactly. I think that is so important, that there needs to be a culture of consent. When, you know, if a young man were to touch a woman without her consent, he'd be in a lot of trouble. But a doctor can just go and do whatever, and there's like very little communication involved in that. Sometimes people, someone described recently of having a nose rape, where they were actually grabbed and held still as somebody shoved a COVID swab up their nose as they were resisting the test. And that is a physical violation. That is on the same level of being raped. People should not be forced into acts, what really I consider acts of violence.
It's certainly, I agree with you, what I consider part of rape culture. My own project's called Men Against Rape Culture. This is part of rape culture. American Indian women were sterilized in the 60s and 70s by force. Puerto Rican women were forcibly sterilized. Women on the Marshall Islands and some of the smaller islands where the nuclear testing was done, that was good for health, right? Mm-hmm. But they weren't white people, so what did we care, right? Yeah. Anyway, you know, all those people were forcibly sterilized. To me, what I first teach my granddaughter is no means no. I grew up in rape culture. No meant yes. She said no because she didn't want to seem like a hoe. So therefore, no meant yes, but she just didn't want to say yes. No, no means no. You don't have to let a doctor put his hands on you. You don't have to not ask for a second opinion. You don't have to submit. But this is hard when there's one medical clinic in a small town or a rural area, or when there's one doctor that takes your insurance in that area. That's what makes it difficult if you don't have transport, because you're subject to the whims of that particular quote-unquote professional.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also just kind of an attitude that people in general have that it's okay if it's a doctor.
Yes.
Yeah. It's okay if the doctor's forcing my child to be touched and they're crying and they don't like it, but this is okay because it's a doctor.
Yes.
I once heard that in, I don't know how true it is because I'm not from China and I haven't been there, but they have like little models or little dolls that they work with in the doctor's office. And they, especially when dealing with a woman, where she can point to the part on the doll that's giving her difficulty or describe the symptoms so that the doctor's not actually touching the woman's body.
I think that's excellent.
But they have a central point where they can talk about the physical issue. I think that's such a great idea. I'd love to see that being introduced. And when the doctor has to do an examination saying, is it okay if I touch you in this way? Is it okay if I examine this? And just get the consent. Like, how hard is that? There should be
I agree with you
on that.
I agree with you, and I'd like to add something. I think that the world over, but the United States, which we're focusing on here, I think there needs to be a trauma-informed sexual mm-hmm. violence questionnaire that is maybe like an 8-point, like they got these little mini depression scales they give you. I think there needs to be a sexual victimization scale or a trauma scale administered to each and every patient. So you're not starting from scratch. You already know, oh, this person has had these experiences. Now I can make some referrals. Maybe now I can understand that their bodily pain is actually a manifestation of rape trauma syndrome, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And it's not even always sexual per se. There's just a lot of trauma that happens in the medical field. Like right now with chronic pain patients, my best friend and partner experienced this. I witnessed it firsthand, and I'm hearing from so many chronic pain patients, they're being put in the same scenario where they're told you have to get these epidural steroid injections or you're not going to get pain medicine.
Sure.
And it's jump through this hoop, allow us to stick this thing into your spine, let us do a procedure that's actually, I believe, not even FDA approved. And there's a whole host of complicating reactions and results from this.
Sure.
That again, the ones who are doing this are, oh, well, sorry, that just happened. You know, you're on your own with further disability and further pain and everything. These people do not want to go into these epidural steroid injections. They're doing the research on them that does not resonate with them. They're going in, they're getting injured. And to me, that's like a form of rape. You're penetrating someone without their consent and holding their medicine, what they need, out of their reach so that you're coercing them, you're forcing them into this.
Yes, and it comes down to that whole idea that, oh, you're the authority because you have two letters at the end of your last name. I remember when I had state insurance in Massachusetts, I had to go to a therapy place in Alston in order to get the nurse practitioner to write my prescription for clonazepam or Clonopin, which is one pharmaceutical medicine I do take. It helps with my anxiety in minimal doses. In order to get my medicine, I had to go to the worst therapist I ever met in my whole life. And if I didn't go once a week to that therapist, I could not get my medicine that I wanted, that I knew helped my body. I could not get that medicine unless I saw that horror therapist. It was the most degrading thing. Talk about rape. I mean, it felt so invasive.
Yeah, my partner was in a situation like that. I remember one time they had him in tears. And like, this is not healthy. This is, you're traumatizing this man.
Sure, I agree.
And that's no good. There's no investigation into the trauma that people are experiencing. People whose lives really depend upon opiate pain medicine, they're having their lives ripped away from them. They're being told you can't have this medicine that manages your pain so that you can work and be a productive citizen. You're going to have to go on disability right now.
And, you know, even with muscle relaxers in Minnesota on state insurance, I broke my neck. I was trying to get Soma, Flexeril, I'm allergic to. And so I was trying to get Soma. They made me try 7 non-narcotic muscle relaxers, which had absolutely no effect whatsoever. So, of course, after like a week of taking them, I threw each one of them away. So 7 months went by with the horrible stiffness and pain in my neck I was having post-break, and I still could not get Soma because the state made me try all those other medicines in order to be able to be eligible to be considered for Soma, as if I was going to, you know, take Soma and go off the deep end and become a Soma addict.
Yeah, it even comes down to imaging. Like for myself, I do not want to be x-rayed. I don't want additional radiation.
Sure.
And I've been told that other kinds of images like MRIs are not available because I don't have insurance and also because I do have insurance. So
yes.
Gotten refused for them both ways. And these are safer, more accurate forms of medical imaging. Like these
yes.
should be the front line that everybody's using, and the X-ray should be gathering dust in the storage room in the hospital, because why do we even need to use that inaccurate and dangerous technology when we have better alternatives? Is somebody on there with you?
This is the love of my life, who came to say hi. She's helping water the plants, the yerba buena. Her great grandma is 78 years old from southern Mexico, and she has a wonderful herbal garden. So here's Aria saying hi.
Hello there.
Say hi, Miss Heather Lynn.
Hi.
Hi.
When did my daddy go sleep?
She says her daddy went to sleep. Can you go water the herbs for us while daddy's talking?
No, my dad talking to my mom.
Okay.
Okay. Well, she's adorable.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's what we're fighting for, the next generation. Hoping that it's a better world for them.
For sure, for sure.
So I know you're talking about growing and gardening. I totally support that. The Victory Garden concept is as valid today as it ever was, and maybe more so, especially as our medicines are being impacted and taken away, and we don't really know what to expect tomorrow.
Sure. Yes, I'm going to make 4 raised beds here and back. And so the herb garden will stay where it is, and I'm going to make 4 raised beds. I use only organic materials, organic soil, etc.
Mm-hmm. Going back to what you were saying before about President Trump. So we've heard that he's taking hydrochloroquine.
Yes.
Just saying it right. To prevent the coronavirus. It's an anti-malarial preparation. And because of the negative press about him taking that, now nobody can get that. I understand for COVID prevention. But that right there shows the disparity. So you have our president who's very wealthy. He can go to his doctor, just have a relationship with his doctor, one-on-one as an equal, and get a prescription for something, whereas the rest of us will just have to go without because we don't have that kind of privilege. We don't have that kind of access to our doctors. And I think to really change the system, that's the goal, is that everybody has that kind of access and relationship to their doctors.
Where we're all equal. We're all equal.
Mm-hmm. We're all experts, too.
Yes,
we all live in our own body.
We're our own subject matter experts.
Mm-hmm. So when we meet with a doctor, it would behoove the doctor to listen to us as a fellow expert.
Yes.
And actually listen to our experiences and knowledge of our own bodies.
I agree.
So many times when you hear of a death through medical malpractice, the patient is all the while screaming, I need this, or don't give me that. They know what they need. And it's when those requests are ignored and overridden that we have really I believe it's the leading cause of death in this country is medical malpractice.
I would not doubt that at all. I would not doubt that at all.
Especially right now.
Yes.
I think you mentioned something before earlier in the show about also the rates of heroin addiction had been staying pretty steady up until the focus on opiates as the new demon drug for the war on drugs. And that's very true. The rate of opiate addiction has been traditionally very low. It's been unchanged since the Civil War era, about maybe 2%.
Mm-hmm.
And in that era, you could go and buy your opium preparations legally. They were,
yes,
like, not really banned until later in the country.
Yeah, marijuana in 1937. Marijuana Repeal Act. Yep.
Right. Yep. So we've traditionally, human beings have spent most of our time on Earth coexisting with opiates and cannabis and coca and just all those things, psilocybin mushrooms.
Yes.
Somehow humanity survived and was doing a lot better than we appear to be doing now in this prohibition, this. I do see a relationship in it to the rape culture, definitely the racism and the classism. It's all just so interwoven. When we're talking about the lack of medical freedom, we are talking about systemic racism and classism.
Thank you. Rape culture, in Spanish, I call it una cultura de despojo. Despojar is like, I come into your house and take everything you have. Or, you know, it's a way of violently appropriating what someone else has or is. And so, yes, white European, quote-unquote, medical culture is rape culture.
It
has taken and usurped. It killed off the wise indigenous people that were here that knew all that knowledge about mm-hmm. these herbs in the forests and plains and coastal areas of the now United States, or what we call Turtle Island. And so it killed them off. And then it said, okay, we're going to be the experts. Why do you have to buy an article from an academic journal for $40 online? Shouldn't quote-unquote knowledge, although it's only partial because it comes from white Europeans, but shouldn't knowledge be free?
Yeah, I believe in a medically free society, these peer-reviewed medical journals should be public access.
I agree completely.
Because I love reading medical journals whenever I've had access, like in college or whenever I had some window in, I would read them.
Sure.
And some of these articles I would read and think, my third grade science teacher would just pick this apart and say, that's not following the scientific method.
Yes.
And I think we need those third grade science teachers to be looking at these, because a lot of them wouldn't pass their classes.
I agree.
I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to the Medical Freedom Radio Show on WGXC 90.7 FM in ACRA. Our listening area is through Columbia and Greene counties and the Berkshire Hills. Our guest today is originally from that part of the world and now living in Denver, Colorado. His name is Frank Aflito. He is a patient activist, and actually so much more, also of someone who is fighting against rape culture in our society, just pushing for more equality and more equal say for people in the medical environment that we should have the say over our own bodies. Your message is right in line with our message here on the Medical Freedom Show, because that's exactly what we want to see. We want to see people having the respect of experts when they walk into their doctor's office, that their doctor is actually going to listen to them and their experience and take that as fact.
And if he doesn't or she doesn't, walk out.
Yeah. You know, one of the ideas I've had with medical freedom is also because we live in this very litigious kind of social environment right now.
Yes.
I see it in many ways where it also would protect doctors more so, because it would be between the doctor and the patient to draw up a treatment plan. Mm-hmm. And the doctor could say, I disagree with you. I don't think you should take that medicine, or I really think you should take this vaccine. But it's ultimately going to be up to the patient. So afterwards, there will be a record that shows what the patient requested. So if the patient, say, died of the disease that the doctor wanted to vaccinate them for, let's just say, for example, that happened.
Yes.
The doctor would be protected because there it is in that contract that this is what the patient chose.
We have a problem because most doctors are allotted 15 minutes to see a patient.
Yeah. We need more doctors. And that's another thing, are the barriers in place to prevent more people from more diverse walks of life from becoming doctors in the first place. That goes again to the classism, to the systemic racism.
Medical education should be free, plentiful. Mm-hmm. It should be holistic. It should include, you know, what they call now, I don't know, alternative formats or whatever, you know.
Right.
This whole pill popping culture and surgical culture is not what the universe intended, if you ask me.
Mm-hmm. Right. Everything should be on the table. What we have is allopathy, which means working with patented medicines.
Sure.
And they're mostly derived from oil and petroleum products, synthetics. Something that can be patented in a lab and reproduced.
And patented by rich white men.
Yeah. So that really shuts out a lot of medicine that is there to benefit people. Like if you go to a doctor in the United States and you're coming down with a cold and you have an important thing coming up or something, you want to prevent this cold any which way, they're just going to look at you and say, oh, it's a cold, we can't do anything.
Right.
But if you go to a doctor in, say, England, where they use combined modalities, they might say, well, here's some vitamins for you. Here's some echinacea to help boost your immune system. You could go home. Here's what you can do to try to nip this thing in the bud and kick it. It's just so much more empowering when we have all the different medical science, all the different modalities, all the treatment at our fingertips. One of my recent guests on the show was talking about how little doctors get to study in nutrition. It's like a taboo subject in medical school. They don't want to devote those hours and that focus onto nutrition, because that's not just something that you can patent and product. And
the ultra specialization, I studied social psychology, the you know I mean, even just the stuff, the hard sciences, you know, no money goes into social sciences and studying health psychology and how people relate to the medical professionals and how they would like to relate to medical professionals. Yeah. Money doesn't go into that. It goes into, you know, what color is the left wing of a butterfly who lives in Ohio? I mean, it just, it makes no sense. You know, right. The priorities are not defined by the people who need the benefit from being empowered. The lack of empowerment, as you say, is hurts the health of people, and it actually kills people. When you feel helpless, when you feel powerless, oftentimes you give up, and when you give up, you lay down and die.
Yep. I'm trying to look at a way to correct the problems that we have right now. It seems that nothing short of a full revolution is in order.
For sure. I would like to see people starting off with perhaps mini health collectives, say like here in Denver. Maybe I could hook up with a couple different people. I actually think I may have lupus, and I know a woman with lupus who's dealing with chronic pain. Maybe starting small self-support groups of people who are chronic pain patients, not in a hospital setting, regular folk getting together. And so, you know, maybe starting out with some collectives, we can evolve those into pressure groups. Because, yes, we're going to need an absolute revolution in this country. Yeah. This country was founded on rape, murder, torture, enslavement, and the list goes on and on. So, you know, obviously, health of a large amount of the people that live on this territory has never been a priority for the rich white elite.
Yeah. I like your idea about groups, and I'm thinking even – like with the chronic pain patients, how meeting in a group is usually difficult for them because a lot of them have mobility issues, transportation issues, care issues. But today we've discovered how much we can do with Zoom.
Yes, we have.
Meetings. So I think that might be a good avenue for us to explore.
Sure.
It's meeting collectively in those groups. That's true. That gets ideas flowing, resources.
Sure, sure.
So much going. One of the things I would like to see is a means for people to become certified in a specific medication, even if they're not a doctor. So let's say a person who's a diabetic, there should be a means for them to be certified in insulin, that they've done sufficient amount of study in insulin and how it works, that they don't need a doctor and a prescription when they need their insulin. They can just go to a drugstore and buy it. I'd like to see that for
people. I'm taking notes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'd like to see that for people who are on opiates too. Like there should be something where an individual can become certified, can demonstrate their knowledge. Because often the patients have more knowledge about their specific medication or condition than the doctors that they're interacting with.
Yes. Quickly, my favorite breakfast, I'm not a big drinker, is called zambaglione. It is a glass of Chianti from Italy with two raw eggs. My ancestors have been drinking that for years and years. They're not alcoholics. In Afghanistan, to quiet children down, they give them a little bit of opium in their bottle. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I know that there are cultures that use things that are not age dependent that they feel are helping with health. I think it's very important for people to bring ancestral teachings in and discuss some of the benefits or deficits of those as well.
Absolutely. It's so important to look outside of our own culture and our own narrow viewpoint. For one thing, the studies that most drug theory is based on were studies that were done on captive caged lab rats, where they would put a rat into a small box, a very unnatural prison for any animal, and give them an option to dose themselves with an opiate. And they find that the rats in these boxes would OD and kill themselves.
Yes.
But then another researcher did the same experiment, basically, had the opium dosage available to the rats, but instead of being in a little cage isolated, they were in a rat society where they're interacting with other rats and they have things to do.
Yes.
And none of the rats in that situation would sit there and overdose. So again, that goes back into the scientific method, which I think is very important and very overlooked in most clinical research that is occurring out there.
I agree. There's a head, a very prominent Dutch-American trauma specialist out of Harvard or in that area. His name is Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. In an early book in the 80s, he quoted two studies, one that said opiates are an excellent stress medicine for trauma survivors, another that said cocaine, pure pharmaceutical mm-hmm. cocaine, is an excellent antidepressive. And these were scientific method studies with trauma survivors. And so, yes, there was a book I read when I was like 15 by John Gardner called The Sunlight Dialogues. Talk about the rats in the cage all isolated. Oh, so you poke a crab to see if it'll move so you can study crab movements. No, what you're studying is a poked crab.
Right. Exactly. The research has been really skewed. Frank, we are within the last 5 minutes of our show already. Are there any resources or links you would like to share with our listeners if they'd want to do more research or more investigation into your causes or work?
You can certainly look up a wonderful group who I really support called Breaking Free. They work holistically with women who have been trafficked or are at risk of trafficking, including, or perhaps even focused on Native women there in the territories. A wonderful person you want to get in touch with at the Little Earth Residents Association of Minneapolis, LERA. Her name is Ms. Cassandra Holmes. She has been working on health issues of local natives, diabetes, pollution concentration in the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. She's an amazing patient activist. She would be someone who would know quite a bit about what LERA's doing and about the issues that inner city Native Americans and others in the neighborhoods in East Phillips are facing. So I think there's a lot out there. Get on Bing, get on Google, whatever works for you, and reach out and help people. And you know, Ms. Heather Lynn, for sure, if you want to think about starting a weekly chronic pain get together on Zoom, I'd be more than happy to talk about that with you. This has been an honor and a privilege for me, a tremendous honor. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure to have you on the show. We have a couple minutes left to keep going. So we talked also about the rape culture aspect. I'm really glad that we got to introduce that into the show today. I don't think we've really connected those dots together.
Yes.
On the show, but really what's going on with our medical industry is rooted in rape culture. It's rooted in systemic racism and classism.
Yes, they want to they want to own your body. They want to establish ownership of your body, and thus they will establish ownership of your dignity. And so, yes, this is a war.
It is. It absolutely is. And I think we need more independent practitioners. And I like what you say, kind of like, you know, because people who are dealing with the health condition are a great resource because they have so much experience working with their own bodies, working with their own experience in that condition.
For better or for worse, I wake up in this same body every day.
Yeah. Exactly. We all do. We are all experts. We are all PhDs in our own selves.
Yes, we are. Can I leave you all with something? It's a Palestinian quote. It would be to men and women or people of all genders, Yatikum al-Afye, which means basically, may the Creator give you the required strength to keep on going. So Yatikum al-Afye.
Thank you for that. Yes. We certainly need that. People.
We do.
The chronically ill and the chronically pained right now have a very, very tough fight.
Don't be afraid to speak up. Don't be afraid to pull help from where you need it. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to pull strength from where you need it. You know, don't let them intimidate you. They got a big system and they got a lot of money. But like Bob Marley says, there's one thing they can't take away, and it's the fire. It's the fire take away that fire in our hearts.
Thank you, Frank Aflito, and thank you everyone who's tuned in today and listened to our show. We will be back next month. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much.
This is Heather Lynn Martin in the Medical Freedom Show, signing out for now.
Good night.